This week, author Julie Otsuka won the Penn Faulkner Award in Fiction, beating out hundreds of other novels and short story collections with her slim but powerful novel, The Buddha in the Attic. You might remember we spoke with her about it. It's set at the beginning of the 20th century, when thousands of Japanese women came to the U.S. to the men of their dreams, or rather, of their photographs. These were the picture brides, because all they had were photos and letters from their betrothed as they traveled like a wave over the sea.
On the boat, we were mostly virgins. We had long black hair and flat white feet, and we were not very tall. Some of us had eaten nothing but rice gruel as young girls and had slightly bowed legs, and some of us were only 14 years old and were still young girls ourselves.
Author Julie Otsuka reading from The Buddha in the Attic. Every paragraph a collective voice of hundreds of women, at times sounding like a Greek chorus, at other times lovely waves of grain. From their arrival as picture brides to the days decades later when they'd be packed off to internment camps during World War II. A topic out of Julie Otsuka's own family history that she first mined in her debut novel, When the Emperor Was Divine. When we spoke with Julie Otsuka about her book, The Buddha in the Attic, we asked why she used this multitude of voices to tell her story.
I did so much research for this book, and I wanted to include all the stories because there were so many fascinating stories that I stumbled across. And I had originally actually tried to tell the story of one picture bride, but it just felt kind of flat to me. And I, for several months, I was just kind of floundering and trying to figure out how to tell this story. And I was looking through my notes, and I saw this one line that jumped out at me, and it was the line that's now the first line of the novel, "On the boat, we were mostly virgins." And when I saw that line, I thought, aha, that would make a great first sentence for the novel. And I thought, if I used what I call the we voice, the first person plural, it allows me to tell everyone's story. So you have these emerging eyes that surface every now and then.
Yeah.
But I found the we voice to be very freeing.
It's like a group of people sort of bound together. And you've said elsewhere that you thought this was appropriate because the Japanese are communal.
They are. And their experiences here in America were also very communal. And Japan is a very group-oriented culture.
Well, and we know you mentioned all this research you did, and we can see that in some of your notes. So tell us how much then in the book is true. Do we know what the women talked about on the ships? Do we know that they slept in bunks at the Fair Wrench in Yolo when they got to the West Coast, or on a bed of straw in John Lyman's barn? Do we know? Are those facts?
Well, the names are not factual, but almost everything is factually true in terms of where these women worked, the towns that they scattered to after their arrival in America, their lives as migrant farm workers. I had to imagine what they spoke about on the boat, but I could fairly easily guess from my research what their fears and worries about America might be.
And also what they expected. They were sadly disappointed because their husbands were not 18 and virile and living in beautiful mansions.
Probably more than half of them ended up working in rural areas, but some of them did work as domestics in the cities. And their experiences varied. I mean, most women had very, very physically challenging lives, working in the fields or working as maids. But I think by the time the war broke out, many of these couples had experienced a bit of success, especially the farmers. They did fairly well, but it took years and years of hard work, I think, to establish themselves in America.
Well, and then we come to the internment. Again, it comes up in this book. Are you surprised, first of all, to find yourself writing about it twice?
I am. I thought I would veer away from the war for my second book, but there was a piece of unfinished business from the first novel, and that was, I always wondered what it would be like to be a white townsperson living in an area, in a city or in a town after your Japanese neighbors had been sent away, and what would you think? And the last chapter came out of that thought, and I knew, I think, fairly early on that I wanted to kind of flip the we voice. We, the brides, would turn in at the very end to we, the white folks in a town after the Japanese had left.
Well, when you're still in the Japanese voice, as they're leaving. And it was an ordered evacuation, so they're on buses, they're leaving. Some of us left weeping, some of us left singing, one of us left with her hand over her mouth and hysterically laughing, a few of us left drunk, others quietly with our heads bowed, embarrassed and ashamed. And then you switch to the Caucasian voice, the white voice, and they say, our mayor assures us everything's okay, but they start to observe this almost ghost nature to their town. Would you read some of that?
We begin to receive reports of lights left on in some of the Japanese houses and animals in distress. A listless canary glimpsed through the Fujimoto's front window, dying koi in a pond over at the Yamaguchi's, and everywhere the dogs.
You know, it begins to tug at your heart. And yeah, you wonder how this could be, that people would just see half their town disappear.
When I was on book tour for the first book, I would often run into people, Californians, who were alive during the war, and they would tell me that they knew nothing about what had happened to the Japanese during the war. They hadn't heard the story before, and I would think, you know, really, how could you not know? And I remember speaking to one white woman who was, I think she was in kindergarten or first grade, and she remembers sitting next to a Japanese-American classmate, and she said one day she was there, and the next day she was gone, and I never knew what happened to her, and I wondered how her parents would explain her classmate's disappearance to her.
Well, and somebody must have known, because as you write, soon, a lemon tree is dug up over at the Sawadas. Locks are jimmied off of front and back doors. Cars are stripped, attics raided, stovepipes pried loose. Is there some, I don't know, what about for you in writing this? Is there, did you satisfy that need? Is there some sense of, I did this now?
There, I mean, I feel like I grew up knowing a little bit, you know, and I feel like there's so much unexpressed anger, I think, at least in my own family, and I'm sure many Japanese-American families, about that experience and what they went through during the war. And I feel like I wanted to give that anger a quiet voice. And I feel like there's so many stories that I ran across and also that I heard during my travels.
Well, you sure packed a lot of them into this slim but powerful little book. Again, it's called The Buddha in the Attic. And I was waiting, you know, The Buddha in the Attic, what's that? And then it's just in passing in one paragraph. It's the things they stowed away at the time when many of the Japanese didn't want to have their Japanese-ness seen. Or is it, do I remember that correctly, that on the list of things that were just sort of hidden away, a Buddha in an attic?
That's correct. And many of the Japanese would destroyed all of their Japanese possessions. But I just like the idea of one person stowing away a Buddha in the attic and it's still being there somewhere out there, even right now, all these years later, unfound, still laughing.
Julie Otsuka, her novel about turn-of-the-century Japanese picture brides from their arrival on the West Coast up until their internment around World War II is called The Buddha in the Attic. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin. My pleasure.